From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2015 when a startup company called Juno brought its ride-hailing service to New York City. Juno's founders wanted to do something different than the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world. They wanted to be what they called socially responsible. To them, that meant allowing drivers to keep a bigger part of their fares and be eligible for a form of stock ownership in the company. But just a few months later, an Israeli company bought Juno, and the founders dropped the restricted stock plan. They said they couldn't find new investors to finance the plan's growth, and so employees lost out. But here's a different example. Earlier this month, an investment firm called BlackRock sent a letter to its public and private clients saying that in order to receive the firm's support, they need to contribute to society. It's too early to determine how effective that pressure might be, but in BlackRock's opinion, it's a start. What's called social impact investing is on the rise according to some measures. According to the Forum for Sustainable and Responsible Investment Foundation, socially responsible investing assets hit $8.72 trillion in 2016. That's an increase of a third in just 2 years. Considering the Juno story, among others, though, is it realistic to think that social impact investing is sustainable? The New Yorker just had a piece basically saying it's losing. Well, this hour, our guests share their insight and predictions. We'll talk about what it means to be a conscious capitalist. Joining us in studio is Andrew Brady, co-founder of the Rochester Chapter for Conscious Capitalism. Andrew, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Zach Armstrong is here, a financial advisor at Sage Ready. Zach, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for having me as well.
Hubert Van Tol is here, president of Pathstone Enterprise Center. Hubert, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And on the line with us is Alan Ziegler, who is a member of the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation. Ray Beff, good to have you on the phone. Alan, how are you?
Thanks, Evan. I'm fine.
I want to solve a little mystery our listeners may have had. If you were listening to the end of the program last hour, you might have heard a mild expletive come out of me. And first of all, I want to apologize for that. Second of all, as the host of this program, nobody ever told me that you never assume a mic is not hot. After all these years in broadcasting, how come nobody told me that? I'm going to solve a mystery because a lot of people were wondering what I was remarking on as the last hour closed. I said, wow. I said something else besides wow. But I said, wow. And what I said right after that when the mic closed was, it seemed like every restaurant owner in Rochester called the program in the last 10 minutes. And it was an indication of the interest in the subject, and a lot of people wanted to weigh in. We just didn't have the time because a lot of those phone calls came in late, and there were a lot to say. But I promise, if you listen to the last hour, two things. We will continue to revisit that subject and to develop it and to hear from a lot of different voices out there. We value those views, and that's already the second program we've had on the tip worker credit. It's important. We will revisit it. Second of all, if you did call in the second half and didn't get through, sorry about that. There was just a flood of interest, and we will try to make sure your voices are heard in the future program. And third of all, that one's on the host, everyone. That one, accountability is a good thing, and I made a mistake. So I'm sorry if I offended you. I was just remarking at all of the interest. But interest is good, and I suspect this hour we're going to have a lot of people listening with things to say about conscious capitalism. So having gotten all that out of the way, let's do this. You know what was going on 30 years ago this week? Wall Street, the movie, was in theaters. It starred Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko. He was a quasi-Carl Icahn corporate raider. And I want to listen, if we could, to Gekko's famous speech from the film. I know you know one of the lines people kind of mess up over the years. But also, I want to pose a question. If Oliver Stone wanted to do this film again today to convince people that Gekko's philosophy was sort of morally odious and wrong, well, did it work? Couldn't this speech be delivered unironically and to applause today?
The new law of evolution in corporate America seems to be survival of the unfittest. Well, in my book, you either do it right or you get eliminated. In the last seven deals that I've been involved with, there were 2.5 million stockholders who have made a pre-tax profit of $12 billion. Thank you. I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
That was in theaters 30 years ago this week, and that landed an Oscar in Michael Douglas's hands. But Oliver Stone made Gordon Gekko the villain of that film, and pretty clearly he wanted to send a message that there was something odious about that destructive corporate rating mentality. Here's the irony. In the 30 years since Wall Street came out, Oliver Stone, Michael Douglas, and Charlie Sheen say that countless people have approached them on the street to thank them for making the film because it convinced them to become Wall Street traders. They loved the lifestyle that the film portrayed. So if it was a film about the moral problems of Wall Street, it largely accomplished the opposite. And Alan Ziegler, I'll start with you. Is greed good?
I don't think so, Evan. There are those who will defend it at some level. I think if it were greed alone, it's possible that it might not be harmful, but pretty doubtful. I think it just multiplies and gets out of hand.
Andrew Brady is the co-founder of the Rochester Chapter of Conscious Capitalism.
Yeah, so I have a really quick story that I want to share that talks about what happens when we overfocus on profit to the detriment of all other things. And that's when you think about the peacock and why the peacock has such a large tail. And the reason is that when it's trying to attract the peahens, the peacock's tail, the larger it can grow, it's supposed to signify the health of the peacock. It's a generally pretty good proxy measure for that health. But what happens is that over the course of successive generations, peacocks have actually grown such large tails that it's no longer a good proxy for the health of the peacock because they're putting so much metabolic energy into that tail that it's actually detrimental to their overall health. And so that's what's actually happened in some aspects of corporate America is when we overfocus on profits. Yes, profits can be a good way to show how healthy the company is, but when we overfocus on that, it might actually end up being detrimental to the overall health of the whole system.
So define for me conscious capitalism, Andrew.
So conscious capitalism is based on four tenets. There's, first of all, a higher purpose beyond just making profits. You need profits to survive. You got to keep the lights on. But the purpose of the company, to engage employees and all these other sorts of things that purpose can bring, you need to go beyond just making profits. They also have a stakeholder orientation. So rather than prioritizing the needs of the stockholders and, that Wall Street, greed is good mentality, it's how do we balance the needs of the customers, the employees, the community, the environment, the supplier relationships that company has, really that whole ecosystem that surrounds and supports the business. They also have conscious leadership. That's the third tenet. So leaders that are empowering of their employees, and they're really servant leaders rather than kind of a command and control old style. And then the fourth element is a conscious culture where they're really focused on the well-being of their employees. And what was actually found from a 2007 study that was done in a book called Firms of Endearment that really started the conscious capitalism movement, these companies, paradoxically, by not focusing just on profits, they made about 8 to 10 times the S&P 500 over a 10-year period. So they were more financially successful by focusing on this model.
Okay, so there's a definition for you. I want to read from a headline from Bloomberg earlier this month and turn to our other guests for some thoughts about what it means to actually invest in companies that are doing well. Here's the Bloomberg headline. Socially responsible investing isn't just for cranks. I love the premise of that everybody just assumed it was cranks who cared about this stuff. But anyway, here is the piece from Bloomberg, and I'm going to quote from them. Before I quote, though, they wanted to make a distinction. If you hear the term shareholder activist, that's different than activist shareholder. A shareholder activist is someone who's all about the shareholders. That means the bottom line, the bottom line, the bottom line, health of the company, much more in the Carl Icahn model than an activist shareholder, who is someone who is a shareholder but also an activist about some of their social worker ideas and environmental causes, et cetera, et cetera. But here's what the piece says. Quote, there's an opening for type 2 activism, activist shareholders, as a business. Jana Partners, LLC, plans to launch a new fund this year dubbed Jana Impact Capital to invest in companies that the hedge fund believes are good bets but could do better for the world. The fund's board of advisors includes Sting and others who have a track record of pressuring companies on environmental, social, and governance issues. Socially responsible investing, long the territory of smaller gadflies, has grown in popularity in recent years, and the presence of Jana, one of the most well-known activists on Wall Street, boosted by Sting, is expected to lend even more legitimacy to the idea. Jana's first project in this vein is to join with the California State Teachers Retirement System to badger Apple to develop new software tools that would help parents control and limit phone use more easily, and to study the impact of overuse of phones on mental health, end quote. If they can get Apple to tell parents to tell their kids not to get on their phones, that would be pretty amazing. So we'll be watching that, and I want to ask Zach what you think about, you know, the question on, you know, whether it's viable, whether we should really expect there to be the anti-Carl icons, or at least a firm like this, an investment opportunity for people who want to do good with their money. Is that viable?
I think that's very viable. I mean, I see it in my own personal practice, and, you know, a lot of the companies that we closely follow are starting to develop much more of a focus on, you know, these ESG, which stands for environmental, social, and government type of responsibilities. You know, companies have the ability to contribute to society in a positive manner, and they can do things environmentally, like help, you know, reduce and try to eliminate carbon emissions, invest in things like renewable energy. On the social side, really look to help out, you know, their workers and their employees from a diversity, gender perspective. You know, you look at things on the corporate governance side as well, looking at things like fair pay structures across the board. You know, are executives, you know, treating not only their workers fairly or their own compensation practices fairly? So these are all the different types of things that we like to look at. And the more and more I've seen pushes being made from activists, the more and more I'm seeing companies have to make changes. And that's exactly the power of, you know, this socially conscious push that we're seeing.
Now, Hubert, Gordon Gekko would be nauseated by socially conscious investing, I think, anyway. And do you think 30 years after that film, there has been any real change in the disposition of this country toward companies like that, of the success and power? I mean, the power dynamic still is in favor of the Gordon Gekkos, isn't it?
I think the power dynamic is definitely still in favor of them, and we've seen that with the recent federal tax cut. But I think the people are shifting underneath that structure to a different view of what they would like their investments, what they would like their money to be able to do. You know, I run a nonprofit CDFI, or Community Development Financial Institution, and we find ourselves finding money quite easily right now of banks, foundations. There more and more there are individual people who are making making contributions or investments in CDFIs because they would rather see their money being used for something locally that helps the local economy rather than getting a higher return and seeing it off somewhere else.
So give me an example. We'll talk a little bit more about Pathstone's work, some of the stories that kind of illustrate this.
In our case, we're a lender in Puerto Rico, for instance. So when the hurricane came through, a typical investor lender would probably have immediately charged off all of those loans because most of those businesses were without power, without water for a number of months. We provided all of our borrowers with a 5-month forbearance and have been gradually working with them to see how we can restructure their loans, make sure that they can grow in the future. So that's a different mindset than a typical investor would take to a situation like that.
I want to turn back to Alan Ziegler, who is with the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation, that hosts annual awards. They call them the EFIs, the Ethical Business Awards, are designed to put the spotlight on companies that are trying to do right in various ways. But Alan, I think there's some cynicism, and I want you to address this as best you can, having witnessed the process of trying to sort of vet these companies, because you know, Zach brought up the idea of all kinds of issues and things that companies might have to address to make people really make them believe that it's socially conscious. Sometimes it's gender pay or gender equity, things like that. So let's say there's a company that has big gender disparities and gives all women in the company a marginal increase and does it because they want to write a press release and say, you know, such and such corporation values women in the workplace and is raising wages of every woman in the workplace, but knowing it's still nowhere near parity and knowing that it's primarily for the headline. But they're going to get that headline. And the problem is when stories like that pile up, and there are many stories like that, the public gets cynical that anybody is truly doing right or truly doing anything that's not bottom line first. How do you sort to try to kind of sort that out and you know, how do you avoid that kind of cynicism, Alan?
Well, let me just go back to the beginning of our program, Evan. Ethics typically only makes the news when you hear about the breaches in ethics, you know, the Enrons of the world. And RABEF was formed to try and celebrate the other side of that issue, to shine a light on those with strong ethical cultures. And we have a very strenuous judging process to do our best to figure that out. We have both a narrative process where the companies fill out an entry form, and we then make sure that they have the proper documentation for those things. But perhaps the most important thing we do to try and find out the reality of their culture is to make a site visit and talk not only with the executive team that was responsible for putting together the application, but to interview two or three employees selected at random to just ask them, did you know you had an ethics program? Has it worked? Have you ever had to accept any relationship to it? Anything in your work life that's been touched by it? So we work very hard to make sure that these companies are heavily vetted so that we can stand behind the fact that we are willing to award them an ETHI for their exceptional ethical culture. Beyond that, the other thing that I think is going to work is as we build up a greater body of companies that have been an ETHI recipient or an ETHI finalist, it will become the norm in this community. And I think that will help cure the cynicism so that instead of them being unusual companies, they'll be normal companies. That if you haven't received an ETHI or if you aren't in our honor roll as a finalist or recipient, you'll stand out as opposed to the other way around as it is now.
I want to share just a couple of stories with the listeners that indicate how difficult it can be sometimes for companies and how pressure can sometimes push in different directions. Well, news came out about half an hour ago. Under pressure from Major League Baseball's commissioner, the Cleveland Indians are going to stop using Chief Wahoo as an insignia on all of its merchandise by 2019. So by next year, Chief Wahoo is gone. I'm from Cleveland. I took my son to a game last summer, and I told him, nothing with Chief Wahoo on it, buddy. We're not doing it. And we're going to tell the people who sell the merchandise there at the stadium in a very nice way why. I mean, we didn't get this done ourselves. But there was a lot of pressure. And what did the Indians say privately? What were all the reporting was, well, you know, fans aren't going to like it if they remove Chief Wahoo because of pressure, because it sells, it's very profitable. You know, and now you've got the pressure. The Major League Commissioner, I don't know his views personally. I don't know how strong they were, but certainly he's responding to some external pressure, and they're making a decision that's forcing a company's hand whether it's good for their bottom line or not. But it took years of pressure. So maybe that is a cause for optimism. But then look at these stories. Etsy, people have heard of Etsy. It allows craftspeople to sell their goods online, and it kind of became known for its employee perks. But it's lost most of its stock market value since it went public in 2015. Hedge fund investors have been pushing the company to reduce its costs and to lay off employees, saying, you know, you're just not going to be viewed as a good option until you cut some of your costs. And here's Peter Capelli, a business professor at Wharton. He told The New Yorker, quote, it is incredible how vociferously the investment community seems to object to being nice to employees. It's a reminder that in the corporate world, things are constantly yielding to the finance guys, whether they know they're doing it or not. End quote. Andrew Brady, you know, I know these are just a couple of small stories, but we opened with the story of Juno. They wanted to be the ethical Uber. And within months, they lost sort of that game plan and they were bought out. Are you cynical? You seem like the least cynical person I know, with the exception of maybe Ken Burns, which is like who's like uh-huh. has had his cynicism surgically removed at birth. How, though?
Yeah, so you make a great point. For those that don't know, there's a concept called a benefit corporation where companies can go through a pretty rigorous process to show that they, by sustainability measures, by social good measures, are meeting certain criteria, and those levels get raised every year. So every time you recertify, you have to meet even higher standards. And Etsy, I believe, was the first benefit corporation to go public, and so that was really a big test of whether this model could stand. And they have been getting a lot of kind of pushback pressure. And so it's really becomes important to recognize how the ownership structure does need to change. Unilever is another great example of a company that's really taken a triple bottom line, conscious capitalism kind of a focus in terms of the products that they're selling and the people that they're employing and the things that they're doing. And they've been getting a great deal of pressure in terms of, from those activist investors that are trying to really get them to be more money driven. And so it does need a change in ownership structure. I know that, for example, in Germany, as part of their corporate boards, employees are given a few seats on the board so that everyone, all of the different stakeholders are represented. And so that there does need to be some different forms of governance, different forms of ownership, different forms of structure to make sure that all the stakeholders are being represented. And then, of course, there's other stakeholders that never get a seat at the table, like the environment, right? Like certain pieces of it that we really do need to make sure that all of these ownership structures and all these interests, so to speak, are at the table and have their voices heard.
All right, so let me follow up with Andrew on this, and I want to ask all of our panelists about this. And then in our second half hour, we'll take more of our listener feedback. Listeners, you want to call the program 844-295-TALK. Do you want to invest in companies that are doing good, and do you trust that you can sort of suss out who is sincere in this, whether it's paying workers more, whether it's environmental efforts or other issues? It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Andrew Alex writes to us to say, Evan, your guests have good intentions, but they are nibbling around the edges of a bigger problem. There will always be a few companies trying to set the bar higher or, quote, do the right thing. But I'm sorry to say that Gordon Gekko was right. In capitalism, greed will always dominate, at least on a larger scale. You want to change it? Got to change the economic model entirely. Alex. Okay, that's from Alex. Andrew, what do you say about that?
Yeah, I can't blame him, right? There is definitely a feeling. Actually, there's a recent study that Harvard did, I believe it was, that said that 51% of millennials no longer believe that capitalism is the best form of an economy to run the economy. And so that becomes a real issue for those that are currently in power to recognize that people are losing their belief in this system. And for us to make a change, it's really going to require a more conscious way of doing business, because what happens when people don't feel like they have power is eventually they rise up and they take it. And so there could be some shakeups at some point, but I think that there is this moment for capitalism to really show all that it can do and all that it can be for a more equitable growth. And I always say that this growth, any growth that you have, is not going to be sustainable unless it's inclusive, whether that's at the local level here in Rochester or whether that's across the economy.
There's no way Carl Icahn would agree with you there. He would laugh at that. So I'm just going to ask you directly.
Please.
Do you think capitalism is antithetical to, sort of wage equality and other issues that we might view as socially conscious?
So I'll give you a great example. I'd encourage anybody to go check out, Walmart is well known for cutting costs at every possible corner. And so what they actually did was, their labor was another cost that they wanted to, pinch all the pennies, and that led to a level of service where it was really damaging. A lot of people didn't want to go to their stores. And I think it was about 2 years ago, they decided that they were going to raise wages And they've seen that it's lower turnover. They've seen that it's led to higher customer scores, you know, feedback in terms of the customer experience and the conscious capitalism kind of counterpoint to Walmart and Sam's Club had always been Costco, which actually paid their employees 40% more than Sam's Club, but had a higher profit per employee, higher productivity. They had people that stayed in their jobs longer, that valued their jobs more, that connected with the purpose of the company. And so when you do see people as just another expense to minimize, mm-hmm. then you can get in that mindset. And if you do it from a more conscious capitalism perspective, a longer term perspective, you see that there are all kinds of cost savings to the lower turnover, to the more engaged employees. And that's why conscious capitalism, again, is showing in the long run, they make more money and there's impact investing that's shown the same.
All right, Hubert, is capitalism antithetical to fairness?
Well, I think when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was faced with a similar crisis that we're facing today, he very consciously stood up to the titans of Wall Street, the titans of industry, and brought a whole new set of regulations that made our system more fair. I think we're facing that same crisis today. We have people in power right now who think that they can tear all those regulations down. I don't think, you know, capitalism totally freed, libertarian capitalism works, but I think a capitalism that is properly regulated and that has people at the top who began thinking in terms of conscious capitalism can survive.
Okay, Zach?
You know, I would say there's certainly a lot of areas for improvement on this topic. I think greed still controls a lot of things when you look at corporate cultures. But one of the things that, you know, I think is encouraging and, you know, brings to light the capability to make a difference is that you're starting to see people in power, people with large, you know, political monetary influence, bring up the possibility of change. You know, the story we talked about with the CEO of BlackRock, which is essentially the largest asset manager in the entire universe, saying that contribute to society or you will risk losing their monetary support as a company. One of the things that I see, you know, in my own line of work, I work with individuals in doing their investments and retirement planning at Sage Ruddy. And you know, almost 20% of all dollars that are currently invested across the globe today are now invested in socially conscious, socially responsible, impact-based types of portfolios. And this trend has essentially been skyrocketing over the years. So I think one of the things is the more we see, you know, money flowing to these types of causes, the more we see people in power standing up for what's right, the more we kind of have the ability as a society to change a narrative. I mean, you can see it in certain individual companies. I think Nike is an example. You know, many years back, Nike was criticized as having a lot of issues in outsourcing their jobs and a lot of their products and apparel being made in truly, you know, sweatshop type of conditions where there was terrible labor, terrible pay. And they started to take a lot of, you know, national disapproval from a lot of different companies, social people with social focuses. And over the years, Nike has actually been a pretty positive turnaround story, especially for, you know, socially conscious investors, because Nike's now a company that you can point to that scores very strongly in terms of, you know, what we look at in the investment community is sustainability, responsible type of grades across the board. They're now scoring, you know, towards the top of their peer group with their business practices. So I think that, you know, certainly, you know, based on the question, I think we have a long way to go, but I certainly see things that can lead to improvement and give me optimism about the capabilities as this develops more and more.
But Zach, Emily writes to the program and says, how could I possibly know what is in my investments and know if I'm actually supporting good causes or not?
Yeah, I think that, Emily, is one of the biggest challenges that a lot of people have. You know, the way that the investment world works, you have a lot of bundled funds and, you know, indexes and things that you might own. There could be 500, 1,000 or more individual companies that are in any individual portfolio. And, you know, as an individual investor, it's not easy to necessarily tell, you know, what you're holding, what types of business practices a particular company might be involved in. You know, one of the things that, you know, I make sure to do for the people that I work with is, you know, we break down and customize portfolios and make sure that companies that we find based on overall scoring metrics are, you know, not environmentally friendly, social friendly, governance friendly, companies that are scoring low on a socially responsible scale, those are companies that we're not going to invest in. Those are companies that we've removed from people's portfolios. And we tend to, you know, focus investments and dollars more so towards people that are having positive contributions to society. You know, a company like Microsoft, which is a massive behemoth and can still prove to be very profitable and have, you know, strong business focuses, get strong grades from the socially responsible community, and, you know, have a lot of initiatives around renewable energy and the environment. So it's not an easy task if you're, you know, left to do that on your own. But one of the things that we work to do is to make sure to do that for people.
All right, I'm late for our only break. So I'm going to get back to Alan in a second, because when we come back from our break, one of the things that the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation claims is that conducting yourselves in an ethical manner is actually profitable. And I'm going to ask Alan about that, because, you know, certainly there have been plenty of unethical behaviors that have led to a lot of money. You can go back to the financial crisis just 10 years ago, and a lot of the people who sowed the seeds of that have done just fine for themselves, even though they've caused a lot of pain to other people. So we'll talk about that and a lot more with our guests. I just mentioned Alan Ziegler from the Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation. You just heard Zach Armstrong, a financial advisor at Sage Ready. Hubert Van Toll is president of Pathstone Enterprise Center, and Andrew Brady, co-founder of the Rochester Chapter of Conscious Capitalism. We continue after this short break on Connections. And let me tell you what's coming up Tuesday on the next Connections. A week before the January 31st recertification deadline for handgun owners in Monroe County, as many as 30,000 licensed gun owners haven't renewed their permits. Why? Well, some are upset that the rules have changed. Others don't understand the process. And the county clerk, Adam Bellow, is trying to make the process more accessible. He will be in studio with us tomorrow talking about how to make that happen and answering any questions you have. That's tomorrow on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Alan Ziegler, I think the idea is that when people are educated about the good ethical choices that a business makes, they're more likely to support them. And I want to believe that. I want to ask you about that. And I wish I had the clip of comedian Jim Gaffigan talking about McDonald's. Jim Gaffigan says, you know, you can tell people all you want. This is fatty. This is heart disease. This will shorten your life. And people will go, oh, man, that's horrible. I'll have a Big Mac, two large fries. I mean, it doesn't necessarily move people very much. And McDonald's still sells 1.5 billion burgers a day. So I don't know if there's a parallel. We can hope that people with education will make decisions that will make it more profitable for companies to do good. Do you believe that that happens, Alan?
I do, and I just want to reference another Harvard study. Andrew mentioned one. This was done by John Cotter and James Heskett of the Harvard Business School. Over an 11-year period, they looked at over 200 large firms and to try and determine, did corporate culture have any financial impact? And they found that the revenues increased by 682% versus 166% for those that did not have a culture. Their workforce increased by 282 versus 36%. Their stock price 901% versus 74%. And the big one is their net income is by 757% versus 1%. And it reminds me of the last quote by Mr. Zink in the Mr. Fink rather in the BlackRock story, and he wrote that, quote, social responsibility is one way for a corporation to generate goodwill as a byproduct of expenditures that are entirely justified in its own self-interest. So I think as we begin to spread the word that, in fact, as Andrew alluded, a strong corporate culture, including ethical behavior, improves your financial bottom line. And if that's the case, and particularly with the advent of so many millennials who will be the next consumer market, saying that I think college graduates now rate that the second thing they look for in a company is, I'm going to call it a strong ethical culture, but things like honesty, trust, etc., as the new workforce and also the new purchasers, I think that's going to have an enormous impact. And by the way, just an aside to Emily, who called in, you mentioned the quote, Evan, earlier about JANA Impact Capital, the new fund. So that's a place where Emily could go with great confidence that she's investing in the right kind of companies.
Okay. Zach, agree on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of great companies out there that are focusing on socially responsible initiatives in today's world. You know, one of the things that's been a great benefit is we've gotten away from just the old, you know, avoiding the sin stocks and the old levels of socially responsible investing that really just removed a couple companies that we might have seen as offenders. There's all sorts of different programs and investment strategies that we look at now that can take into account a plethora of different, you know, socially conscious topics that are important to investors. And you know, I think it's important to note from an investor perspective, all of those topics probably may slightly vary amongst each individual. Everyone's idea of, you know, social responsibility may be a little bit different. And that's why we like to look at different, you know, strategies and different opportunities to explore what's important to each individual.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, I think that Zach mentioned earlier, he was talking about Nike, and it's an example I use often as well, just in terms of, you know, a company that had always put out these great marketing messages, but then you find out that they had these sweatshops, you know, in developing countries. And so I think one of the pieces that's really creating this conscious capitalism movement or this impact investing is that there's this increased level of transparency. When you have, you know, the internet, you have everybody's got a phone in their pocket and a camera in their pocket, you know, it wouldn't go too long if a company was putting out these great messages, but then they weren't living up to that in terms of their actual practices. So that happens not only from the way that they're sourcing, but also there's places like Glassdoor where you can go and hear reviews from people who've worked at companies on what it's like to actually work there. So you know, if you want to attract the best employees, you better have a culture that's going to be you know, attracting to them. And then even when you go to the customer experience, if a customer has a bad experience, they can tweet about it, they can post it on Facebook, it can go viral, all those different sorts of things, both good or bad. And so really creating that kind of culture and having that transparency, I think, is what's taken what's always been good business practices, but now making it actually more profitable, essentially.
All right, let me grab a phone call. Wendy in Rochester. Go ahead, Wendy.
Yes, I was very lucky to find someone who would do what I wanted in terms and had done the research already for another client on not being invested in any fossil fuels. And I've actually beat the market on this recently, not that I expect to every year, but The other thing I wanted to say, though, is that I don't think people understand that just because your money is invested in some kind of pension plan that your work allows you, doesn't mean you don't have the right to transfer that money into another investment with the same tax benefits or whatever. You're not stuck with whoever your pension plan is. At least in my case, I wasn't, and I think it's true for a lot of people. If you don't like where they're investing, you can set up your own account somewhere and transfer out as long as it's the same sort of investment in terms of taxes.
Wendy, thank you for the phone call. Zach, can you weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that we see. I think what Wendy's alluding to is a lot of, you know, investors that might have money in, you know, company retirement plans, company pension plans, 401ks, 403bs, these different types of, you know, tax sheltered types of investments. Unfortunately, a lot of plans might not necessarily offer investment strategies that have a social focus or have, you know, socially responsible funds. So one of the things that we see people do, you know, quite often, especially if they're, you know, not currently working at that employer, is roll those funds over into an IRA and have the ability to, you know, then develop their own customized, socially conscious, you know, social impact type of a strategy. And I think a lot more people are doing that because of the options that allows them.
Let me read a little bit, though, on the subject of, if you hear SRI, Socially Responsible Investment Fund, is that right?
Yes, that is.
Okay. So the folks at truthout.org aren't buying it. They say that this is a place where there can be examples of exploitation. I'm just going to read from their article on this. They say, SRI funds, Socially Responsible Investing Funds, can have many problems. The overarching one is that these funds work within existing paradigms and do nothing to solve the crisis at the root of most of our problems, capitalism itself. In fact, capitalism with a conscience, together with business-friendly conceptions of sustainability and labor rights, can give cover to new and more insidious forms of exploitation. Many companies will produce slick corporate responsibility reports, or conduct pro forma and staged audits of their suppliers, or simply focus their efforts on convenient non-solutions, end quote. What do you make of that, Zach?
Well, you know, I think it's like anything else. There's the ability for certain companies, if they chose to, they could try to exploit investors. I mean, I've seen certain things in, you know, what are, you know, called and deemed socially responsible funds that are funds that I would not, you know, personally recommend investors invest their money in most cases, because one of the things that I see is certain funds might claim that they're socially responsible or have a social focus. But at the end of the day, if you look at what's happening underneath the hood, they might not actually be all that different than any other, you know, regular investment fund. We see companies that say, hey, I'm a socially responsible index and things of that nature. And unfortunately, in some cases, that might be true, that all they're really doing is mirroring the stock market or something like that. That's why it's important for us to make sure we know what we're buying. Mm-hmm. We make sure that it's a customized strategy, things of that nature. So in some cases, that might be true, but in certainly not in all cases, in my opinion.
Do the homework. Don't just see the label.
Certainly.
Hubert, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I come at this from a running a community development financial institution that is an intermediary, in effect, for social investment. So I haven't spent time, you know, studying, you know, what is involved in someone investing in a socially responsible investment fund. So, you know, from our perspective, you know, we applaud the overall movement towards people paying more attention to SRI and the movement towards conscious capitalism. I think in any movement of this sort, there's always a certain amount of hype, and you know, you have to, as was said, you have to pay attention to the details and learn a certain amount yourself about what it is that you want to invest your money in.
So for you, what's the safest and surest bet to feeling good about how your money is invested?
You know, you can now find community development financial institutions around the region. There are some in Maine, there are some in Vermont. Unfortunately, there are none in Rochester or the upstate New York region yet, where people are paying 2-3% on investments and are turning around and investing it in local businesses. So that's the most hands-on, direct way that you can be sure of what's happening with your money. But unfortunately, we all do have 401ks and 403bs, and it isn't quite as simple to do that with those. So you do have to, I think, have, you know, those kind of filters, structures to help you, guide you.
Let me read an email from a listener who writes from her business account today. This is from Teresa from Eastside Dog Services, LLC. And I love how she starts. She said, I've emailed you before for the program, but not for my business email, because I'm generally just voicing an opinion. But today I'm writing about my business as the owner. And here's her story. She says, from the beginning, I knew I wanted to run a different kind of business and use my position as owner to be a force for good in the community. I started that by not taking a bank loan. I have no business debt, so I am only beholden to my employees, my goals, my community, and my consciousness. She said, I own a small business. I buy only products made in the USA, including our uniforms and supplies. I get as much local as possible. I sell goods from other local businesses and their products to support them. I pay my employees on a regularly increasing scale above minimum wage, and for half of my small staff above Monroe County's living wage. They all get raises every quarter. This means there are times that I bring home less than they do, but that is what it takes to build a sustainable business from the ground up. I am passionate about making a business model that supports itself and the employees that run it. I was unemployed when I started my business and deep in student debt. I had nothing. I invested time and effort, sweat equity, if you will. 3 years later, I have a booming business that does not fully keep up with our demand and 4 happy employees. It can be done. You just have to care enough, be creative, and passionate about your people. Again, that's Teresa from Eastside Dog Services. And I'm going to believe that everything you just told me is true, Teresa, because I didn't vet it. but I'm sure it is. And congratulations on that, Alan. That's probably an example of the kind of stories that Rabeth wants to tell.
That's exactly the kind of story we'd like. She's doing it exactly the right way, and she's proven that by doing it that way, she's built a profitable business. And I'm sure she goes home happy at night, which is a side benefit, which may not be financial, but is critically important. I know that Andrew just posted a blog on LinkedIn talking about purpose and how so many companies let purpose go by because we're having a tough time financially. But here's a woman who decided that the purpose is going to be paramount with me, and it's paid off in both financial and psychic satisfaction. Perfect story.
Thank you, Teresa. Thank you for sharing that. And as we move toward the final minutes of our program, I want to revisit something that Andrew Brady, who is the co-founder of the Rochester chapter of Conscious Capitalism, said earlier this hour. Depending on the survey, I should say, it doesn't really matter the survey. Multiple surveys have been done, and his generation, millennials, whether you want to accept it or not, they are having a harder time with capitalism. They have more negative things to say about capitalism than preceding generations. And one of the things I mentioned when I hosted the Effie Awards for Rabeth last year was, you know, the business world needs to, needs to fully understand that capitalism is not a given that it will survive in this country, given the dissatisfaction, given the wage disparity, and given the politics. I mean, Bernie Sanders did very, very well, could have won a nomination, came close to winning a presidential nomination, could have been president. And he's got some very strong critiques of capitalism. This is not sort of gadflies in the corner of the bar ranting on a Tuesday night down at your local tavern. This is a generation of people who are questioning the tenets of it. Do you, looking forward, Andrew, believe that your generation in particular is going to change on that? And what would it take to change that?
Yeah, well, we started with the greed is good speech. There's a long line of Milton Friedman all the way back to Adam Smith, who was really the founder in some ways of what came to be capitalism, kind of the godfather of capitalism in some respects. And what he talked about and what he's most often quoted for is that it's not by the benevolence of the butcher and the baker that we get our dinner, but it's by their regard for their own self-interest. But what a lot of people don't know is that before, or in addition to Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations that is most often quoted, he also wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is really about how to the points that we were making earlier, that it shouldn't be an unrestrained capitalism. Any kind of unrestrained growth, at the cellular level, that is like cancer. If we have an unrestrained growth, it becomes cancerous to the whole, and it ends up killing the whole. So what we've done over the course of evolution is we have an immune system to fight against those unrestrained growth, that unrestrained cancer. And so what Adam Smith talked about was, in addition to that self-interest, we also need this sense of community, this sense of shared purpose. He wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments and actually said that no society can surely be happy of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable. But that part of Adam Smith doesn't get talked about enough. And so I think that we need to really understand that, yes, we can have a capitalist system, but if it's not based on a shared sense of fate, a shared sense of responsibility, and a sense of community, then it, as you're saying, it may not survive.
Alan, I don't want to date you, but you're not quite in Andrew's generation. And so are you concerned that the younger generations have a more negative view of capitalism?
No. I think they're a smart, interesting group of young people. And I think, to Andrew's point, as we make capitalism fair and bring in some of the principles of conscious capitalism and ethical behavior, I think those young people will see that it is far and away the best economic system. But as Andrew pointed out, it can't go unrestrained. I have great confidence in it.
Hubert, your thoughts going forward on what might change that disposition?
Well, I would agree with what has been said, right before me here, that it's very important that it not be unrestrained, but I think that there is definitely among younger people some striving to figure out why there is so much income inequality now, because I think the huge income inequality is part of the cancer that's eating at the society right now, and we have to figure out what are the structures we can put in place to alleviate that, to diminish it, to make it a better society.
Zach, your thoughts on that?
I think we have the ability, especially in my generation, and Andrew, I think we're both probably around 30 or so in that generation, where ideally we can define a new structure, new circumstances, a different way of thinking about capitalism that can become a little bit more beneficial to society as a whole. And that's kind of part of my goal in looking at society. And I think, a very important factor in taking steps in that direction is the practices of businesses, having socially conscious business practices. As an individual, if you're able to do your part and have socially responsible investments, that's, one step out of many to try to better the dynamic of the capitalistic structure that we have.
Again, watch Apple. If somehow Janet gets Apple to start telling parents to get their kids off cell phones, maybe this is doable. I want to thank our guests and Andrew Brady with Conscious Capitalism, the local chapter. If people want to get involved, how do they do that?
Yeah, ConsciousCapitalismRock.org. We have local tours of local conscious capitalism businesses every month. You can get on our mailing list, and in May we'll have our second annual conference.
Website again.
ConsciousCapitalismROC.org.
Zach Armstrong, financial advisor at Sage Ready. We know where to find you.
Yes, Sage
Ready is all over town.
Sage Ready is all over town, and SageReady.com is probably a good place to start to look up myself and my group.
Hubert Van Tol, president of Pathstone Enterprise Center.
I would go to the website of pathstone.org, www.pathstone.org, and you will find us there.
Thank you for being here. Much appreciated. And Alan Ziegler, Ray Beff, Rochester Area Business Ethics Foundation, 10 seconds. What do you want people to know?
That we have applications for the 2018 ETHIs, and we urge you to look at the website and apply.
Thank you very much for taking the time, Alan. Always good to talk to you, sir. Thanks. Our thanks to Tim George and Rob Braden, keeping me protected from myself on the mic. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow.